Hello, I'm Donald Johannesson, and thanks for joining me on Speaking Out. On Speaking Out, part two of the biennial Mabo Oration, organised by the Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland.
Waleed Ali said, "Australia is generally a very tolerant society until its minorities demonstrate that they don't know their place. The minute someone in a minority position demonstrates that they're not a mere supplicant, we lose our minds."
The 2015 Mabo Oration, which was recently held in Brisbane and delivered by Dr. Dawn Casey, that's coming up on ABC Speaking Out. But first a song. This is Original Aboriginal, the first musical recording produced by Dave Quinlan. That was Original Aboriginal, recorded for the very first time at Sydney's Long Bay Remand Centre, a place where Dave Quinlan was awaiting trial. The song is featured on the compilation CD, Our Home, Our Land.
Speaking out.
Speaking out.
Culture.
Culture.
Lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
And current affairs.
You're listening to Speaking Out on ABC Local Radio, Digital Radio and Radio Australia. I'm Donald Johannesson. Thanks for your company. The 2015 Mabo Oration was organised by the Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland and was recently held in Brisbane. Dr. Dawn Casey is the 2015 orator and follows in the footsteps of past Indigenous orators, including lawyer Terry Janke, Professor Larissa Berendt, Dr. Tom Kelmer, Indigenous rights advocate Les Melzer, and Noel Pearson, who delivered the inaugural Mabo Oration in 2005. In part two of the Mabo Oration, Dr. Casey talks about her time with the Indigenous Land Corporation, the current constitutional debate, and the current government Indigenous policy. Dr. Dawn Casey's title of her oration is The Mabo Judgment. Was it the agent for change and recognition? Enjoy part two of the 2015 Mabo Oration.
By far, my most difficult learning experience was to do with my father. He was born just outside of Croydon around 1909. When he reached the age of 65, as shown on his driver's licence, he had to retire from the Cairns City Council and applied for an age pension. He was advised he needed to provide a copy of his birth certificate. This was not possible, as Aboriginal births were not registered. After much discussion with the Social Security Department, I contacted the local state MP of Parliament. I remember his name, Ray Jones, Labor. He obtained the department's acceptance of a signed declaration confirming my father was born around the time in question by a suitably qualified person. My father's mother was Aboriginal and his father was a white cattle station owner. There was a family member on his father's side who lived in Cairns, so we visited her to seek her agreement to make the declaration. My father had worked since he was around 7 years old, first on the cattle station and then in Cairns, where he was highly respected. He had to sit and listen while this old lady considered she could possibly recall he was born at that time and eventually signed the document. I hold no animosity against her for her very patronising words. She was of that era. My father was a man of few words and never told me what he thought, but it left with me an indelible memory and did, I suspect, confirm my unconscious resolve that government policies and systems needed to change. I had by this time already joined the local Aboriginal Housing Society, whose membership included Peter Noble, Clary Grogan, Mick Miller, and not too much later, I became president of the local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Education Consultative Committee. As a public servant in the Commonwealth Department of Education, I quickly gathered that recruitment practices and regulations were severely limited employment and promotion opportunities for women and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I think it's important here tonight to recognise and acknowledge a chap called Joe Kelly, who was the head in Brisbane of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Education and Study Grant schemes in the mid-70s, who strongly pursued the creation of the very first identified positions in this country. In the early 80s, I met Clyde Holding, the Hawke Government Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, when he visited Cairns. At his request, wrote to him outlining the impediments as I saw them. This was a time of transformational change in the public service, brought about by the Public Service Reform Act 1984, sponsored by Minister John Dawkins and public servant Dr. Peter Walensky. In 1984, I went to Canberra as one of the team of two to write Australia's first equal opportunity plan in the Department of Education, where Walensky was the secretary. As you can imagine, or maybe you can't imagine, some of the long-standing public service mandarins were less than happy about these developments, including John Stone, who resigned as Treasury Secretary in August 1984. In an online quadrant memoir published in 2013, Stone strongly criticised Walensky and the Public Service Reform Act as setting in train the politicisation of the Commonwealth Public Service. I went on to work in various positions in a range of government departments, including for a short while as a senior executive back here in Queensland in Aboriginal Affairs, and in the 90s in Prime Minister and Cabinet under with the reconciliation, whose joint chairmanship was Patrick Dodson and Sir Ronald Wilson. Another of my responsibilities was coordinating the deaths in custody, the response to the Aboriginal deaths in custody. The Royal Commission's various reports remain an important social and historical documents, and really people should reread, and governments should reread, the underlying issues report. In 1994, I received a call, and I was actually in Washington, from a colleague who worked with me in the Prime Minister's Department. This resulted in me being given the task of coordinating the development, design and construction and building of a new home for the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies and a new National Museum of Australia. I was appointed the director in 1999. It was for me a really interesting career choice and not taken lightly. Museums are culturally significant, visited by millions of people, including school children, but I could see how museums could help create a greater awareness of important issues such as looking after the environment, raising the status of women, educating people on the culture and history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. It also meant I would be in a position to negotiate and speed up the repatriation of Indigenous human remains and secret sacred objects from museums in Australia and overseas. It was an issue I'd been concerned about for many years. The new National Museum opened on 11 March 2011 as the largest single Commonwealth-funded project for the Centenary Federation celebrations. We used an innovative construction agreement called Alliancing, and the project was completed on time and within the budget.
The Speaking Out website is abc.net.au/speakingout, or just search for ABC Speaking Out.
Donald Johannesson joining you on Speaking Out, ABC Local Radio, Digital Radio and Radio Australia. You're listening to the 2015 Mabo Oration delivered by Dr. Dawn Casey in the Queensland Performing Arts Centre. In part two, Dr. Casey highlights the Mabo High Court decisions.
After my departure, the Museum Council in 2006 refused to approve the listing on the National Collections Register of a painting by one of our most recognised Aboriginal artists, Queenie McKenzie, on the basis it reflected her interpretation of Mistake Creek massacre of Aboriginal people, the facts of which were being disputed by the cultural warriors. The decision was reversed in 2012, recognising a great work of art and the legitimacy of our Indigenous oral traditions. Kawarta and the Mabo High Court decisions. I will now return to the central theme of this speech, the Mabo High Court judgment and the man who did the most to achieve it. Eddie Mabo was a distinguished Queenslander from a humble background who has left an enormous legacy. I'd also like to pay tribute to the other plaintiffs, Reverend David Passey, Sam Passey, James Rice, Salua Mapo Sully, all of whom, given my age, I have the great honour to have met. The Mabo judgment would not have been possible without the Kawartha decision. In the 1970s, John Kawartha and his community approached the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission for finance to help the purchase of a pastoral property, Archer River, on the Cape York. This was agreed but required the approval of the Queensland Minister for Lands. When that approval was refused, John Kawartha commenced the proceedings against the Queensland Government. In response, Queensland brought a separate action seeking a declaration that the Commonwealth's Racial Discrimination Act was invalid. The High Court's subsequent Kawartha decision upheld the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act by a majority of 4-3. How close was that? Joe Bjelke-Petersen then converted the pastoral lease into a national park. John Kawartha died in 1991, and it took another 20 years for Queensland to make amends. In 2010, Premier Anna Bligh passed a law revoking part of the national park. And in 2012, her successor, Campbell Newman, went to Cape York with the title deeds and delivered an unexpected apology. Meanwhile, in 1982, Eddie Mabo and his fellow litigants had commenced proceedings to claim title to Murray Island and associated islands and reefs on behalf of traditional owners. In an attempt to thwart the claim, the Joke Peterson government passed the Queensland Coast Islands Declaratory Act 1985 to extinguish any property rights the Miriam people may have had before its enactment. In 1988, following the Kawata decision, the High Court struck down this legislation because it was inconsistent with the Racial Discrimination Act. In 1992, as we all know, the High Court decided in Mabo No. 2 that customary native title could be recognised at common law, reversing the long-standing doctrine of terra nullius, that the land of Australia had belonged to no one when the British arrived. In some quarters, the decision was condemned for its activism, and the fear of judicial activism currently haunts the debates about Indigenous constitutional recognition. Many benefits have flowed from the Mabo judgment and the recognition of native title to land. These benefits have been both practical and symbolic. I can answer the question I posed in my title. In the affirmative, the Mabo judgment was an agent for change and recognition, though many issues of Indigenous recognition and rights remain unresolved. The Mabo judgment forced the government to the negotiating table with Indigenous people for the first time in Australia's history. These negotiators included Lower Joe Donoghue, the then chairperson of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, Mick Dodson, then the Social Justice Commissioner, David Ross of the Central Land Council, Noel Pearson of the Cape York Land Council. The Native Title Act was a central part of the national settlement, providing a means to have native title determined as well as other processes. As part of the complex negotiations to put in place a statutory framework for native title, Indigenous leaders agreed to the validation of government acts to extinguish native title between 1975, when the Racial Discrimination Act came into force, and the date of the Native Title Act. This meant land title certainty for other Australians. Everybody's backyards were safe. Many Indigenous Australians were unlikely to benefit from the Native Title Act because their traditional land had been already alienated. So the land account, then called a land fund, was legislated to provide some compensation to the widespread dispossession of Indigenous people since 1788. In effect, there was a grand bargain. This put in place processes to allow for the orderly recognition of native title and some compensation for dispossession without creating widespread uncertainty in the broader community. Disappointingly, governments have never delivered on the third part of the agreed settlement, the Native Title Social Justice Package. As with any legislation, the Native Title Act has not lived up to the expectations of some of our people. For others, however, the Act has provided access to land and resources and a right to negotiate about the future of land, that is, or maybe, subject to native title. We have seen native title recognised in places that would not have been anticipated when the Native Title Act was first legislated. In southeast Queensland, Quandamooka determination in 2011 recognising native title rights over North Stradbroke Island was a game changer. As will be the almost completed Noongar settlement in southwest Western Australia. These are truly amazing achievements. They are a testament to the resilience, courage, and the leadership of traditional owners and others involved in these settlements.
You're listening to Speaking Out on ABC Local Radio, Digital Radio, and Radio Australia. I'm Donald Johannesson. Thanks for your company. You're listening to the 2015 Mabo Oration delivered by Dr. Dawn Casey in the Queensland Performing Arts Centre, organised by the Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland.
The Indigenous Land Corporation. I'm currently the chairperson of the Indigenous Land Corporation, one of the institutions set up after the Mabo judgment, albeit I was just advised by the minister a couple of days ago that I won't be reappointed in October. The ILC has a unique independence from government. The corporation has its own source of revenue, the land account, the compensatory fund legislated as part of the grand bargain. Its board has a majority of Indigenous directors. They are appointed by the Indigenous Affairs Minister but cannot be directed by the Minister. The ILC currently has the discretion and flexibility to pursue Indigenous benefits over the long term at arm's length from political or budgetary cycles. In December 2013, the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Nigel Scully, initiated a review of the two agencies I then chaired, Indigenous Business Australia and the Indigenous Land Corporation. I have no doubt that the Minister wanted the ILC and Indigenous Business Australia to be merged. As opposition spokesman on Indigenous Affairs, he was quoted in the media in relation to the appointment of the ILC CEO, and I quote, the then Minister said, we were appointing someone to a position that might not exist after the election. As the ILC board, we saw the ILC and IBA review as a major threat to a basic part of the native title settlement, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land account. In a merged agency, the land account's revenues would inevitably be used sooner or later for purposes than what was originally intended. The ILC's principal strategy in the face of the threat was to develop a draft bill to amend our governing legislation, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Act 2005. The draft Stronger Land Account Bill was released in March 2014 and endorsed on the same day by a group of senior Indigenous leaders, including Patrick Dodson and three of those who helped negotiate the original Mabo settlement and served on the first ILC board, Lower Joe Donoghue, David Ross and Noel Pearson. The bill developed by the ILC was largely adopted by the Australian Greens, introduced into the Senate in June last year. It was then sent for an inquiry to a Senate committee. Senator Scullion does not support the bill and the Prime Minister so far has refused all of our requests for a meeting. The Stronger Bill has five main purposes. First and foremost, it seeks to protect and strengthen the land account by making the land account's purpose explicit in the legislation. Secondly, it seeks to ensure that funds from the land account can only be used for land-related purposes. The ILC board also supports a request from the Torres Strait Islander Regional Authority that the ILC's remit be extended to sea in addition to land, because currently we can't fund the Torres Strait programs. If legislated, the Stronger Land Account Bill will mandate the highest standards of governance and accountability in the ILC beyond those required in our Act or in the overarching public governance legislation. We want to impose higher standards on the ILC because it is the steward of monies intended to compensate Indigenous Australians for dispossession and for trading away certain of our rights in the post-Mabo settlement.
You're listening to the 2015 Mabo Oration organised by the Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland and delivered by Dr. Dawn Casey in the Queensland Performing Arts Centre. In this final piece, Dr. Dawn Casey summarises the 2015 Mabo Oration and how communities and governments can move forward to guarantee Indigenous rights and a better country for all Australians.
Truly innovative changes are needed in Indigenous policy setting, but can our politics deliver this? In conclusion, I've spoken today on how racial discrimination continues to be central to Australian politics, albeit in a more disguised form than it once was. It continues on the rhetoric of keeping Australia safe, maintaining Christian values, or saving Indigenous people from themselves. Deep down, I'm very uneasy about something what I call the psychology of the nation, the psychology of the Australian nation. The Mabo judgment itself revealed deep fissures in Australian society. After the Wick judgment found in 1996 that Native Title could survive on past releases, Prime Minister John Howard held up a map of Australia showing the vast areas of Australia that could potentially be taken over by Indigenous Australians. The Deputy Prime Minister of the time, Tim Fisher, promised bucket loads of extinguishment. The 90s saw the rise of One Nation policy. Since the current government has come to power, we have seen an attempt to amend the Racial Discrimination Act that would have been detrimental in the extreme to Indigenous people. This year we've witnessed the vilification of Gillian Triggs, the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, for standing up for human and minority rights. In recent weeks we've seen the rallies of the Reclaim Australia with banners saying patriotism, not racism. And I ask you, what Australia are they reclaiming? The AFL crowds have been booing Adam Good, and it wasn't too bad on Saturday night I watched, after his invisible spear dance during the AFL Indigenous round. Commenting on this when I wrote this speech several weeks ago, Waleed Ali said, "Australia is generally a very tolerant society until its minorities demonstrate that they don't know their place. The minute someone in a minority position demonstrates that they're not a mere supplicant, we lose our minds." In this fraught environment, the call for some mechanism to guarantee Indigenous rights for some Indigenous power within the nation is surely a correct one. Above all, I think that Indigenous Australians need protection against bad laws and the ideological fixations of governments, whatever persuasion, or the personal agendas of ministers. There does need to be a Bill of Rights in some form, an Indigenous Bill of Rights, or a wider Bill of Rights covering all citizens. Waleed Ali said, "Australia is generally a very tolerant society until its minorities demonstrate that they don't know their place. The minute someone in a minority position demonstrates that they're not a mere supplicant, we lose our minds." In this fraught environment, the call for some mechanism to guarantee Indigenous rights for some Indigenous power within the nation is surely a correct one. Above all, I think that Indigenous Australians need protection against bad laws and the ideological fixations of governments, whatever persuasion, or the personal agendas of ministers. There does need to be a Bill of Rights in some form, an Indigenous Bill of Rights, or a wider Bill of Rights covering all citizens. In closing, I'd like to pay tribute to all those who've gone before us in the fight for justice and fairness for Indigenous Australians, and indeed for all Australians. I hope in the spirit of Eddie Mabo, I hope the spirit of Eddie Mabo can give us all the courage that we need to deal with the unfinished business that still haunts Indigenous Australia. Thank you.
Dr. Dawn Casey delivering the 2015 Mabo Oration organised by the Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland at the Queensland Performing Arts Centre. Speaking Out would like to thank Dr. Dawn Casey, Anti-Discrimination Commission Queensland, the Queensland Performing Arts Centre, and especially a senior producer there at QPAC, Jenny Hodgson. That's it for another week. You can find individual programs at abc.net.au/speakingout or like us at facebook.com/abcspeakingout or even check out our YouTube page. Just search ABC Speaking Out. I'm Donald Johannesson and this has been Speaking Out on ABC Local Radio, Digital Radio and Radio Australia.